Hello there. Today is Thursday, January 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the impeachment trial of Donald Trump begins as more damning evidence starts to trickle in.
Make it be very clear that this president will be held accountable, that no one is above the law.
President announces phase one of a plan to end the 2-year-long trade war between the U.S. and China. Also ahead, Whitney Houston will be posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, after weeks of fiery rhetoric, a group of Democratic members of the House of Representatives made a dramatic procession across the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday to deliver articles of impeachment to the Senate, paving the way for the trial of President Donald Trump. It is only the third such trial in American history. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Make it be very clear that this president will be held accountable, that no one is above the law, and that no future president should ever entertain the idea that Article 2 says that he can do whatever he wants.
Trump and his allies, like Representative Doug Collins, continue to call the impeachment a hoax, even as new details emerge about Trump's efforts in Ukraine.
This impeachment process has been flawed from the outset. It resembles not a congressional action, it resembles more a Dr. Seuss book, knowing not which way it goes.
Opening arguments are set to begin next Tuesday after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Joining us now, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. He is joining us live from Minneapolis, Minnesota, to understand how this will all play out. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you again.
All right. Well, briefly, what exactly is the president accused of doing?
Well, in a case like this, essentially, he was holding back some $400 million from the Ukrainians, who are in desperate need of that. They're in the middle of a war with the Russians right now, essentially as a shakedown to go out and go after and find dirt on the Bidens, obviously, looking at what Joe Biden may bring to this presidential race and trying to bring him down. That was one aspect of this. The second aspect is interesting based upon what the president has done since that time and continues to do to this day, according to the House, and that's obstruction. And we got to be clear on this one. What the president has done is he has purposely and specifically muzzled every single person he could. He stopped them from testifying. He has not provided one single document. And so that's the obstruction piece of this. And just that single piece alone is a fascinating sort of example of what we're looking at right now, because if you think of it this way, there is a constitutional obligation of Congress to provide oversight. If the president, and this is his argument, says that he doesn't have to because everything is privileged, if that were the case, then it literally makes it impossible for Congress to provide that oversight. So this is something that absolutely has to be looked at.
All right. Well, how is the impeachment of a president supposed to be dealt with as far as we've already heard from the House and now it's in the Senate? How does this work?
Well, if we think of it this way, and this is important, this is not a criminal proceeding. And we have seen some of the president's supporters trying to make this argument that that's what this was. This is not a criminal proceeding. We should say that again very, very clearly. The idea is this, is that this was the intent of the founders from the beginning, was to present this evidence. The House then actually would draft these articles. They would present them to the Senate. What would then happen was you would have the entire process presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in this case, John Roberts. But the members of the Senate, they would be the jurors. What's difficult to handle right now is we continue to see evidence starting to pile up against the president, and yet what you're hearing again and again and again from Republicans, specifically Mitch McConnell and others, is that, well, we are hand in glove with the president, and more importantly, this is a sham. The problem is, if you look at what the Constitution says, the Senate has taken an oath, and their obligation is to weigh all of the evidence and come to a fair and honest decision. It's very difficult to do that when you're working hand in glove and you're saying, this is a sham. What you should do is you sit back and say, okay, show me what you got. And if you've got enough, okay, he will be removed. If you don't, he won't. And it is that simple.
Well, we haven't heard any exculpatory evidence that the president wants to provide to, exonerate himself. The Senate McConnell, as you mentioned, he's already now proposing a ban on any press attending the trial, so no media coverage. How unusual would that be, and how could that impact all of it?
It's incredibly unusual. And my biggest concern is this, is that in the end, really what this is about, I mean, the overall process is that this was an attack on American democracy. That's really part of the problem and part of the issue that says what we're trying to have is legitimate public servants who are doing legitimate work. But most importantly, what this is about is providing transparency so the American people can watch these public officials, their employees, if you will, to make a determination as to whether or not they did something wrong. This is a public fight, if you will. This is something that's presented to the American people. The problem is that this argument that you're going to exclude the press from it literally muzzles that opportunity. And it's amazing when you consider that it was the Republicans themselves who tried to argue that none of this was public in the first place in the House when the investigation was taking place. By the way, that's not necessary that the investigation early on is actually public at that point. Everything was subsequently presented. But when you actually have the process, the trial itself, it needs to be transparent because the American people need to see this so they can also weigh in and say, this person is somebody we want to believe, we don't want to believe, or anywhere in between.
All right. Lastly, you know, there are a lot of still outstanding questions, in part, of course, because the White House has blocked the requested documents from the House during the inquiry, and they've blocked all witnesses. So, but we are starting to see things come out due to the Freedom of Information Act inquiries. And the latest seems pretty explosive. This associate of Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas, and another man running for Congress right now, talking about surveillance of the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine who was removed, who actually testified in the House impeachment hearings that she was called at 1 in the morning in Ukraine and told she needed to get out of Ukraine. So all of these sorts of things seem pretty damning. Can they be admissible as the information starts to continues to come in?
It should be. I mean that really is the problem. At the end of the day, what we're looking for here, and I think everybody should be looking for this, not just the left, not just the right, I mean everybody, is that there should be a legitimate opportunity to simply present all of the information that is being alleged, and to put it before the fact finders, in this case, the members of the Senate. Now, if what they decide is that it is insufficient to remove the president, that is their right. But what you're starting to see is the exclusion, potentially, of massive amounts of information. And then what you're doing is you're throwing a blanket over it by excluding the press. So now you can't see what it is that the Senate is actually doing. I don't see how that actually provides the transparency the American people need. I don't see, more importantly, that you have a fair and due process to ensure that the president has a fair trial and that the House, the articles of impeachment, are honestly and fairly presented to ensure that the president's process is actually fair. That's important to this sitting president, every sitting president, but to exclude it and then cover it up is something that doesn't work for this president or any future president.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice joining us live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We always appreciate your perspective. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, the United States and China have signed a phase one of a trade deal that may help lower tensions between the world's two largest economies. But as White House correspondent Patsy Wuttakuswara reports, much of the trade disputes between the two countries remain unresolved.
On Wednesday, a truce was reached in the trade war between the United States and China that began in June 2018 when the Trump administration began slapping tariffs on Chinese products.
This is an unbelievable deal for the United States, and ultimately it's a great deal for both countries, and it's going to also lead to even a more stable peace throughout the world.
President Trump signed phase one of the deal at the White House with Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, who read a letter from Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Our two countries have the ability to act on a basis of equality and mutual respect and work through a dialogue and consultation to properly handle and effectively resolve relevant issues.
The agreement reduces some U.S. tariffs in exchange for what the administration says would be an expansion of American agricultural and energy exports to China. The deal also includes a promise by Beijing to give more protection for American companies' intellectual property and halt the practice of forcing foreign companies to transfer technology. It remains unclear how those provisions will be enforced. As part of the deal earlier this week, the U.S. removed its designation of China as a currency manipulator. But the agreement maintains U.S. tariffs on about $360 billion of Chinese goods and the threat of additional punishment if Beijing does not live up to the terms of the deal.
But the secret annex supposedly commits China to purchases of very specific different products, different manufacturers, different agricultural goods, some services, and so forth. That annex will not be disclosed, but I suppose it will be used by the U.S. Trade Representative to see whether China's living up to the mark as they perceive the mark, as the U.S. government perceives the mark.
The deal does not address China's subsidies to state-owned companies, an issue likely to be discussed in the next phase of trade talks, which is not likely until after the U.S. November elections. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called the agreement a huge victory for the Chinese.
We've gotten very little in return when it comes to intellectual property, when it comes to people demanding joint agreements, when it comes to cyber theft, when it comes to government-subsidized businesses, the nub of our complaint.
Still, this initial agreement seems to cool tensions between the world's two largest economies, at least for now. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Iranian students stage noisy rallies at four Tehran universities. Powerful Iraqi cleric is calling for massive protests against U.S. troops. A surprise shakeup of Russia's leadership as President Vladimir Putin makes changes to the constitution that could keep him in power well past the end of his term. And forget the mouse, your thoughts can control devices. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israel's Army Intelligence says Iran will have enough enriched uranium to produce one nuclear bomb by the end of the year. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will not let Iran become a nuclear power. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israeli military analysts say that by the end of 2020, Iran will have enough enriched uranium for one nuclear bomb. The assessment comes after recent tensions between the U.S. and Iran brought them to the brink of war. The United States pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, and Israeli intelligence officials speculated that Iran would resume its efforts to acquire a nuclear bomb. Israeli Army intelligence officials based their calculation on their assessment that it takes 40 kilograms of 90% enriched uranium for one nuclear bomb. Iran announced several months ago that it no longer considered itself bound by the nuclear deal and would step up enrichment efforts. At the same time, the Israeli assessment found that Iran does not possess missiles that can carry a nuclear bomb, and that as far as they know, Iran is not working on one. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued a harsh warning to Iran. He said that Israel knows exactly what is happening with the Iranian nuclear program and that Israel will not let Iran get a nuclear weapon. He also called on European states to impose new sanctions on Iran for breaching the nuclear deal. Meanwhile, Syrian state television said that Israeli aircraft fired missiles at the T-4 base near Damascus. The report said that Syrian air defense brought down a number of missiles, but that four hit the base, causing some damage but no casualties. Israeli officials did not comment on the report. Syria has accused Israel of hitting this same base several times in recent months. Israeli military sources said that Iranian forces and allied Shiite militias used the base, and that Iran used the base to transport precision weapons to Iranian-backed forces, including Hezbollah in Lebanon. I-24 News defense correspondent Adi Kaplowitz says Iran is continuing its efforts to deliver weaponry despite the U.S. targeted killing of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani.
The taking down of Soleimani doesn't prevent the Iranians from continuing to try to reinforce their forces all over the region, including in Syria. We are already seeing a report that just 2 hours after the attack last night, another Iranian cargo plane landed in the T-4 airbase, showing that really it's very hard to prevent the Iranians from sending different sorts of equipment or weaponry all over the region.
In February of 2018, an Israeli F-16 was shot down during an attack on the T-4 base. It made it back to Israel before crashing. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Disturbing new reports on the warming of the planet have been released by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Space Agency NASA. The decade that just ended was by far the hottest ever measured on Earth, according to the agencies. Scientists say they see no end to the way man-made climate change is continuing to shatter records as the world witnesses regions plagued by raging wildfires, melting ice, and extreme weather that researchers say is tied to human activity. Several scientists say the coming years will be even hotter, knocking these years out of the record books. Joining us to talk about all of it is Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Tell us about the findings.
What that showed was that 2019 was the second warmest year in the instrumental record, which goes back to the late 19th century. And that was the second warmest year in the five top years of the five last years, and that this decade was the warmest decade on record, and that was a decade that was almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the pre-industrial.
Things are continuing to warm up, obviously not going in the direction that scientists say we need to be going in.
No, that's right. I mean, so what any one extra data point means is small, but the key thing is that the long-term trends are both persistent and coherent across whole suites of different systems. We're seeing the same patterns in the ocean as on land. We're seeing the same patterns on ice as we are in the middle troposphere or further up in the atmosphere. We're seeing these things working their way through into sea level rise, into drier conditions and more more likely fire weather. We're seeing this happen, this changing intense precipitation. We're seeing this working its way through the system and impacting us in many, many different ways.
And all of this is happening because of man-made climate change. Is that a correct statement?
That is a correct statement. We've looked at all of the different things that could be causing climate change. You know, the changes in the sun, volcanoes, wobbles in the Earth's orbit, all the natural things. None of them explain what's been going on in the last century. And then if you take the human components, the changes in greenhouse gases, air pollution, deforestation, ozone pollution, all of these things, you put them all together, and what you end up with is that actually matches the trends that we see almost exactly. And the dominant cause of that is the increase in greenhouse gases, and the most important greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide.
Is this reversible if mankind were to take the actions necessary to reduce carbon emissions, or is it already to the point of it's not going to get better, but we can stop it from getting worse?
We can't really stop it. We're not going back to an earlier time, but we do have a choice as to whether to keep our foot on the accelerator or to slow up and try and reduce the changes going forward. So that's our choice, is to moderate the changes or to just kind of go hell for leather to a much, much warmer world. And the impacts we're already seeing from just 2 degrees Fahrenheit indicate that, you know, for every extra half a degree, extra degree, we're going to start to see more and more an accelerating impact.
If the world continues to emit greenhouse gases at basically the same pace it is, or my understanding is that we're emitting more every year, not less. What does the world look like? And what ultimately will happen here?
It's hard to say exactly what will happen, because I do think that society is waking up to this situation, and that there are good scalable efforts that are happening all across the world to reduce emissions. It's just that those efforts are not yet commensurate with the size of the problem. But what's the world going to look like, you know, under the worst-case scenario? A good point of reference is the Ice Age about 20,000 years ago. That was caused by changes in the orbit of the Earth, which are very slow and not relevant right now. But that was a very different climate. Ice all across the continent of North America, massive amounts of ice in Europe, a very, very different set of ecosystems, tundra where we now have forests, very, very different. And that was a planet that was only about 8 to 9 Fahrenheit cooler than the pre-industrial. And the possibility of where we could end up by 2100 under a burn-it-all scenario is about 8 to 9 degrees warmer than pre-industrial. So you've got like a whole ice age unit, but in the other direction. And if the ice age was a very, very different planet, then that potential future would also be a very, very different scary place. But if we moderate our emissions, if we eventually bring them down to zero and we stabilize carbon concentrations in the atmosphere, then, you know, it's not going to warm that much more. But that's going to take a large and sustained effort to bring down emissions.
Many forms of life would not be able to be sustained. Is that safe to say?
What you would see is massive shifts in ecosystems are viable, and you would see a big shift away from rainforests and towards savanna. You'd see cold-loving species being squeezed out of their ecozones. So, yes, it would be devastating in terms of
if we just stop right here where we are and just at least stabilize where we are right now, which is already warmer than we need to be, what happens to the planet? What happens to life on Earth? Can it stabilize?
Yeah, so if we stopped emitting carbon tomorrow, then the planet would not get any warmer, and eventually it would start to cool down again. So obviously that's not very likely, but it's within the bounds of possibility that could happen, you know, the next 20, 30, 40 years. So we do have the potential to keep this situation under control.
All right, that's Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives.
Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, 2019 was a year of mass protests on the African continent, with demonstrators filling the streets in many capitals, including Kinshasa, Khartoum, Harare, Conakry. While the causes of their grievances varied, the protesters shared one unfortunate characteristic: a harsh response from security forces. VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report from Johannesburg.
There was rage across the African continent last year, says Human Rights Watch in its annual report, with no sign of cooling down. Anger at entrenched leaders in Guinea and Sudan, poor economy in Zimbabwe, and over conflict displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia. But the public outrage is good to see, said the rights group's Africa Advocacy Director, Karine Kaneza Nantulia, at the launch of the report in Johannesburg.
We've seen, I think, the average men and women of the African continent taking agency, being agents for their own, for the changes they wanted to see. We saw an increase of peaceful protest in different countries. The second, I think, takeaway is that we've also seen a backsliding from government in terms of political and civic space.
In some countries in Southern Africa, that meant police aggression and repression, says Human Rights Watch. Dewa Mavinga is the rights group's Southern Africa researcher.
We expected more from Southern African leaders, including President Ramaphosa of South Africa, based on their commitments and promises to fulfill people's rights across the region. But we saw that there was a constriction of space for human rights defenders. In countries like Zimbabwe, there was a clampdown on protesters, excessive use of force by the police and the other arms of the security forces. There was no accountability whatsoever.
But there was also hope, as Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize for liberal reforms and making peace with arch-enemy Eritrea. Babatunde Olugboji is Human Rights Watch's Africa Deputy Advocacy Director.
He's done quite a few great things in Ethiopia. He's released political prisoners. He's actually reforming some repressive laws. He sort of made peace with Eritrea. So things are moving in the right direction, mostly. There is still a lot to be done in Ethiopia.
South Africa takes over the African Union's rotating chairmanship this year, notes Human Rights Watch's Southern Africa researcher, Mavinga. With the continent's most progressive constitution, South Africa's leadership raises some expectations, he says.
South Africa has to step up to the plate. It has to deliver on human rights and draw back on Mandela's legacy. But we will have to continue to push.
And as 2019 made clear, African people will be behind them, demanding their rights and that their voices be heard. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Whitney Houston will be posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The gospel-trained Houston, whose soaring voice transformed the Dolly Parton's cover, I Will Always Love You, into a gigantic hit, was one of four artists elected after being on the ballot for the first time. The annual induction ceremony will be taking place on May 2nd at the Public Auditorium in Cleveland, Ohio, the city where the Rock Museum is located. A Saturday night show will be on HBO, televised live for the first time. Houston, who succumbed to years of drug abuse in 2012, was an instant success after being signed to a record contract at age 19. Her 1985 debut had three number one singles, Saving All My Love for You, How Will I Know, and The Greatest Love of All. She had seven consecutive singles top the charts, a first for any artist. The daughter of gospel singer Sissy Houston and cousin of Dionne Warwick, Whitney Houston just grew up in the business. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy.